The following program comes to you as part of the Africa Health Network, a service of the Voice of America to our audience throughout the African continent.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Linor Mudu, and welcome to Health Chat. Get this, while more than 118 people here in the United States are waiting for organs, and about 18 people die every day awaiting transplants. In many places like sub-Saharan Africa, observers say the situation is more difficult. Being an organ donor can save several lives. However, it is often possible due to the loss of life. Many people feel uneasy about becoming organ donors. On the program today, we will look at some issues around organ donation and transplantation. To enlighten us, we are joined via phone from Boston by Dr. Francis Delmonico, President of the Transplantation Society and Professor of Surgery at Harvard Medical School, Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Delmonico, welcome to the program.
With you.
Okay, and you're there with us, Dr. Delmonico?
Yes.
Okay, great. I hear you now. Thank you so much for joining us. And also joining us via phone from Cape Town, South Africa, is transplant surgeon Dr. Elmi Muller, a counselor of the Transplantation Society representing Middle East and Africa. And Dr. Muller, well, we don't have Dr. Muller yet, and she will join us in a few moments. Let me remind the listeners, if you would like to participate in the show with your questions or comments, you can send them to us via email, healthchat@voanews.com, or you can call us at 202-619-3111, the U.S. country code is 1, and ask your international operator to reverse the charges, or you can post your questions on facebook.com/healthchat. We will discuss organ donation in a moment, but first, here is an overview. Kristen Simpson is at risk of end-stage renal failure. To stay alive, she needs 3 hours of dialysis at a time, 3 times a week. The young woman was diagnosed with nephritic syndrome when she was a teenager, a disease that prevents her kidneys from functioning properly. She is on the organ transplant list in South Africa and has been waiting for a kidney for over 2 years. Simpson underscores the importance of promoting awareness about organ donation.
The first thing to do is educate yourself about it. And, you know, it doesn't mean you have to give your kidneys now. anything can happen. And your one body can save 7 lives.
Organ donation is the donation of biological tissue or an organ of the human body. Experts say the organs from one donor can save or help as many as 50 people. Organs that can be donated include kidneys, heart, bone marrow, and even skin. Most organ and tissue donations occur after the donor has died, but some organs and tissues can be donated while the donor is alive. Health experts say more organ donors are needed, especially in developing countries. Jules Vermeulen is Director of Communications at the Organ Donor Foundation, a non-profit, non-governmental organization that aims to promote the concept of organ donation in South Africa. He says the situation is dire in the country.
Well, currently in South Africa, 4,200 people are waiting for life-saving organs in South Africa, and less than 300 will actually get an organ and live. The rest will unfortunately may not make next year or the year after that. We get people that wait up to 7 or 8 years. So it's really a desperate situation.
The Exchange, a pop-up fashion boutique in Cape Town, recently launched an effort to address the issue. The store does not accept cash or credit. Instead, consumers choose any item in exchange for registering as an organ donor. The store is stocked with clothing and accessories donated by South African designers. Ploy Furomnam, a client, says she's happy to make a difference.
I'm always interested in donating my organs, you know, and it's just a funky way of doing this thing. So I really wanted to support this organization.
The store is a joint project of the digital marketing agency, Native, and the Organ Donor Foundation. The pop-up boutique, which opened this past May, will remain open until all the clothing and accessories have been exchanged. The foundation hopes to increase the list of organ donors to at least 500.
And now I believe Dr. Elmai Moller is with us. Dr. Moller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, welcome to Health Chat.
Wonderful. Thank you for inviting me to attend.
Great. And now let me have, why don't I have you, you know, start the discussion. But we heard the piece earlier. What? Let me have your reaction on what we heard earlier. Just in general, when we hear organ donation, organ transplantation, some people seem uneasy about this topic because very often we tend to think, a lot of people tend to think, if you are donating an organ, it means you are dead. But it's not always the case, Dr. Moller.
Yes, that's correct. We can be, there are living donors and deceased donors. And in South Africa, we do both these types of donors. So not all organ donors are dead. And just a small amount of people who die will qualify as organ donors depending on what they die of and whether they are suitable.
Okay. Now, Dr. Del Monaco, what does it take when let's say you have an organ that needs to be transplanted from one patient to another? Where does the process start, really?
The process starts in the identity of the person in the hospital. Someone who is either going to die or who has died, and a doctor in the hospital who's been caring for that patient must refer the individual, this patient that's either dying or has died, to the organ procurement organization. There's an agency that's set up within the country that enables the recovery and distribution of organs from the deceased. So the process starts by the physician who's caring for an individual in the hospital to think about organ donation at the time of someone's death.
Hmm. Now, does the process differ from one country to another, one region to another, or is it the same process?
No, you know, as it turns out in traveling now around the world, it becomes quite evident that the process is very much the same. In those hospitals in which patients are cared for that have catastrophic injuries that involves either a stroke or a tumor of the brain or some trauma, there is a point for some patients in which the treatment is no longer going to be successful and the coma is now irreversible. The person cannot be restored to a consciousness or awareness, mm-hmm. and the person is no longer breathing on their own. The person can be declared dead by neurologic criteria. Mm-hmm. And it is upon that occurrence that the physician caring for this individual can now consider others, save lives by the opportunity of organ donation.
Okay.
So there is an accountability mechanism in there, which is both a formal one and an informal one, on reporting back on progress of hitting those targets for non-communicable diseases and cancer specifically. Now, I must admit that the nature of the involvement of the local cancer organizations has probably changed in the last few years from being advocates demanding attention to being organizations that actually wish to help governments fulfill those obligations. And let me just hand over to Julie, who works very closely with our members in many countries in the developing world to help them use new toolkits and to talk to the governments about how they can help implement a cancer plan.
Okay, go ahead, Dr. Torode. Please.
Yes, we've been really trying to inform our members about their role as national advocates to make sure that they don't just talk about one particular cancer issue and focus on their own topics of interest, but actually also become advisors to governments. We do need a cancer plan that's addressing systematically the building blocks that Kerry's mentioned, and we do need a cancer registry at every country to make sure that we do know that the efforts that are being implemented are in the right place. If you don't know what your cancer burden is, you're probably spending your money and time on the wrong types of activity. So those are the core things that we encourage our members to talk to member states and talk to their governments about, but also then to encourage our members to really talk about cost-effective interventions, understand the limitations that some of their environments have. But we know that investing now and in taking action now is going to save money in the future. It's going to save money for economies, and it's going to save social economy as well. And we need governments to start making those investments rather than sitting back and hoping that this cancer burden that's coming their way in Africa is not going to happen, because we know it will.
Okay, and Dr. Torode, Mr. Adams, we are so glad you're joining us today. We will take a short break, and when we come back, continue this very interesting discussion with the both of you. And to you listeners, we are grateful you're joining us. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today, because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Dante, AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Welcome back to Health Chat. If you are just joining us, we are discussing cancer today and looking at the global incidence of cancer with an emphasis on Africa and how this is being addressed. Our guests, Dr. Julie Torode, she's Deputy CEO and Head of Programs and Global Advocacy with the Union for International Cancer Control, and also joining us via phone from Geneva is Kerry Adams. He is a CEO of the Union for International Cancer Control. When we talk about cancer, I think there are some people are still a bit confused. Even when you talk to them about cancer and we talk about prevention, you hear some people say, oh, no, you should not have sugar. Sugar causes cancer. Radiation causes cancer. You know, they said the treatment, the type of treatment you take can even have some side effect. All the radiation is bad. So really, there is a very kind of confused messaging, or perhaps some people are confused at least. So what can we really understand if we were to say these are the steps to prevent cancer? There are several cancers, but what are some of the basic steps to prevent cancer? Nothing is guaranteed. We can always try to prevent, although we cannot guarantee that it will not happen. But what can one do to increase his or her chances to prevent the disease?
You're absolutely right. There is a general misunderstanding around the globe, not just in Africa, with regard to the what causes cancer and how fatal it is. It's quite common in the press. The press will pick up a small story somewhere, and it will become exaggerated around the world about a link between a certain vegetable or something and cancer. But let's be clear. The research that's been conducted by the leading academics in the world and scientists over many years have identified what the core causes are, or the risk factors, for most of the common cancers. And we know tobacco is a significant risk factor. We know that obesity is a risk factor. We know a lack of physical activity is a risk factor. We know that excess alcohol is a risk factor. We also know, as Julie has mentioned earlier in the show, that there are certain viruses which cause cervical cancer, colorectal cancer. There's all sorts. So we know all of that information. And if you add them all up, our colleagues at the UN agency IARC in Lyon would say that probably 50% of cancers can be prevented. So that is all available. And I guess the challenge that we have through organizations like my own, as well as governments, is to ensure that we translate that good, solid science into very clear strategies and policies within countries. So there must be a tobacco control policy. There must be vaccinations policies. There must be all sorts of things which align with the science that we know about and has been well applied around the world, which can reduce the burden of cancer in the longer term. So I think that we do, as a community, have a responsibility to express the fact to people so that they are able to make informed decisions. But that's at an individual level. But clearly, there is an obligation on governments to make sure they translate fact into specific policies which are proven to work. And Julie, maybe you can talk about tobacco, because we know that that is obviously one of the biggest issues, and there are proven ways to reduce tobacco use.
Yes, yes, indeed. Would like to hear that.
And although tobacco use is maybe not as prevalent in Africa as it is here in Europe, I think it's an important policy issue that governments across Africa really need to address. And we know for sure that increasing taxation does have an impact and does reduce smoking. And smoking is a risk factor for many, many cancers, a big driver of cancer overall. The same with alcohol. It's maybe not as a prevalent social activity across Africa, but you need to get these policies in place early so that you're not struggling with the issues that we are struggling with here, and we are seeing that many cancers are driven by alcohol as well. And as we become more urbanized, sitting in cars and sitting in our desks at work instead of being physically active, that's a big driver for cancer. So there's many things you can do as an individual to think about reducing your risk, not smoking, only drinking one or two glasses of wine or beer a week, trying to be physically active at least three times a week, trying to keep a healthy weight, trying to have a mixed diet with the fruit and vegetables as well as meats, to really try and reduce your own personal risk. And the other thing you can do is really get to know about the cancers that you can find early, understand the signs and symptoms, so that if you do think you've got a symptom that could be cancer, that you go and find help. Because if you find a cancer early, there's a lot more that a doctor can do to help treat that cancer and hopefully cure that cancer.
Okay.
So I think we do really, and particularly in the areas of breast and cervical cancer, those are ones that we can't necessarily control. You know, breast cancer is largely due to the fact that we as women are exposed to hormones. That's normal, a normal case for a woman, that she's exposed to hormones. And these are a big driver of breast cancer. So you can't necessarily control that, but you can learn about how to examine your breasts, understand what is normal for your breast, so that if you do think there's a lump, you can go and find a doctor and make and check to see if that is something that you should be concerned about. And a breast lump can be removed by surgery, can be treated very simply, but a breast cancer that is spread to the rest of the body is very difficult to treat. So I would encourage people to think about reducing their risks, but also learn about signs and symptoms, find out where they can go for screening, so that they can really find cancer early and make the best of an early diagnosis.
Let me ask you a follow-up question about the breast cancer specifically, because this is obviously one that is very, very common among women, regardless of where they are.
Yes.
You talked about the lump. If a woman finds a lump, she should report. But is it possible that a breast cancer can develop without a lump being a sign of cancer? I mean, can a woman have breast cancer without having a lump? Is it possible?
It's possible, but very unusual.
Okay.
So the normal signs would be a lump or what we call the sort of orange skin type, where your skin looks a bit like an orange or is pulled in,
mm-hmm.
or if there is some fluid coming out of the nipple.
Okay.
So any of those could be signs of a problem, and you should go and find a specialist that can ease those concerns.
Okay.
I would also say that there are often lumps that are not cancer. So just because you find something that feels like a lump, still go and find help, because it might be a cyst which isn't cancer, and therefore you can also stop worrying about it. So yes, there are lumps. Not all lumps are cancer, but if you find something, please go and find someone that can help ease your concerns.
Now, what is one of the first thing, if not the first thing, that one should ask the doctor when they receive the diagnosis of cancer? Because this is a diagnosis that really can leave people in a state of panic.
I think the first thing I would say is it's normal to panic, and it's normal to be confused. So I would suggest that don't worry about bothering your doctor. That's what your doctor is there for. So if you have questions, even if you have them afterwards, write them down and ask them next time you go and see your doctor. What you should really know, of course, is what cancer is it? What are the next steps to decide on your treatment? And if there is anything that the doctor recommends that you can do to help support the best outcome for your treatment.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned side effects before. Some things can be done to reduce the impact of side effects and make yourself manage the treatment better, and a doctor can help you with that.
Okay.
So really you do need to know what is the cancer. Also, what stage is the cancer is also a good question to ask, because that helps you understand your treatment. And I would also say ask your doctor about organizations that can help you understand the cancer more. There's a lot of cancer societies now emerging in Africa, and they also provide information to patients, helping them understand the diagnosis, understand the treatment, and be able to think about questions you might want to ask next time you go to the doctor.
Okay, and on this note, Mr. Adams, let me thank you for joining us today for this discussion.
Thank you very much. It's been most enjoyable.
And Dr. Julie Turede, thank you so much again for your insight on the topic.
Thank you very much.
For more on today's program or other programs, you can log on to our website at voanews.com/VOA Africa Health Chat. Thank you for all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudu, in Washington, with producer Jackson Bungani. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy one.
Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right